wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Sweet. So this week we're starting off by talking about Venus, which is one of the planets in our solar system. And
yes, it is.
There's volcanoes there, apparently.
Apparently there is, yeah. So we haven't been there for a while. Everyone's been talking about Mars, and we've been sending little rovers to zoom about Mars for the last few years, or a couple of decades, really. But we are going back to Venus, and the main question that people want to answer about Venus is, why on Earth is it so hot? Venus is the hottest planet in the solar system, despite it not being the closest planet to the sun. And Venus has a really thick atmosphere that traps in all of the heat, and basically it's this runaway greenhouse effect that's occurred on Venus. And so, there was this discovery of some years ago, this discovery of volcanism on Venus, and people want to know, you know, what effect does that have on the climate, and what other factors have led to this sort of horrible, deathly sort of the heat-trapped climate on Venus. And so, just recently, ESA, the European Space Agency, announced a mission called Envision. And this comes on the tail of two missions announced by NASA called Veritas, that's the first one, and Da Vinci Plus, I think, which is the second one. And they're all headed over to Venus over the next sort of 10 years or so. And the idea is that they sort of have some overlapping interests and in what they're trying to study, but there is some overlap in the aims, but they all sort of fit together, and they're all arriving in roughly the right order. So the first mission is NASA's Veritas mission, which will provide a really detailed global map of the planet's topography. Now, you can't just map by looking down, because the clouds are so thick you can't see the surface, so you have to use infrared light. And so that's the first mission. The second one is Da Vinci. And that's going to establish compositional ground truth, and that's going to parachute a probe through the atmosphere to actually look at the ground and see what that looks like. And then Envision, which is the ESA mission, will follow up, and that will zoom in to understand how surface activity affects atmospheric dynamics. In other words, answering the question, how does the volcanism on Venus affect the climate and everything that goes on?
So have we sent a probe to Venus before?
We have, but not for a long time. And the difficulty with Venus is it's a really horrible atmosphere. It's very, very, very hot. It's very corrosive. And the pressure is incredibly high, the atmospheric pressure. So the probes that have been sent there haven't really lasted very long. It's not like Mars, where they zoom around for months or years. Venus is a much more difficult challenge. And so it's time. The space agencies have decided that we go back and take another look.
Okay. And I forget the order of the planets, but is Venus closer to Earth than it is to Mars?
Venus is closer to Earth than Earth is to Mars. So,
okay.
So it's Venus, yep, is the second planet from the sun. Earth is the third. Mars is the fourth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sweet. So this sounds like it's going to be a great idea to sort of go and have a look at that.
It should be very interesting, yeah.
Sweet. So looking at our next story, we're looking at whether vaccinating adults will stop kids from spreading COVID. And how does that sort of work if kids aren't getting vaccinated straight away like adults are?
Yeah, so these mass vaccination drives in a bunch of countries are providing some new data on the extent to which adult vaccinations are able to protect children. And the good news is children, infections in children have fallen as adults have been getting their shots. But the conclusions about what's happening are mixed. So the experts are disagreeing on whether this means that unvaccinated children are unlikely to become sort of a reservoir for infection. And if that is the case, they could become, children could become a hotbed for the emergence of new variants, like we've seen several new variants, one from the UK, Brazil, India, and other places. And this, the answer to that question affects whether children in wealthy countries should be prioritized for vaccination or whether their doses should go to poorer nations to inoculate adults instead.
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
It is a very tricky one. So I talked a few weeks ago about this town in Brazil where 98% of adults have been vaccinated. And this was a slightly less effective vaccine from China. But what they found was tremendous. The symptomatic cases dropped by about 80%, deaths dropped by 95%. Now, in that town of 45,000, only 62% of the residents are adults. But a similar drop in symptomatic infections occurred in the unvaccinated children. And this was according to the epidemiologist who led the study. And so the question is this because adults are the main people spreading the disease? Or is there some other reason for this? And do we ultimately have to vaccinate kids as well? And we know already that the way in which the virus affects children is just different to the way it affects adults. And this is probably because children's airways have fewer of the receptors that the SARS-CoV-2 virus uses to gain entry into the cells. Yeah. So, for example, in Israel, where there's been a very high vaccination rate, infection rates have plummeted in those eligible for vaccination from about 560 cases per 100,000 people aged 16 and over in mid-January to only about 1.5 cases per 100,000 people today, which is fantastic. And what's better, that most schools reopened in March, but the rates in unvaccinated children also dropped. So from they were similar to the rates in adults, so from about 550 per 100,000 down again to about 1.5 per 100,000 in those aged 11 or under. And that suggests that children are most often infected by adults, and they're not really spreading the disease amongst themselves. And so there's more to study here, and there's more really to understand, but it looks like there's this growing huge demand for the vaccine from some of the poorer countries, and there was a recent announcement at the G7 in the UK that the wealthier countries would donate, you know, billions I think of vaccines to poorer nations, and that's really really important. But if it turns out that children need to be vaccinated, and at least one, I think the Pfizer vaccine has been approved for use in children. If it turns out that children need to be vaccinated as well as a priority, then some of those vaccines will almost certainly be held back, which will disadvantage some of the poorer nations.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of looks like right now we've got a lucky break because, I mean, like, kids are kids. They play around, they touch each other, they put their fingers in their mouths, they do whatever which would sort of come across as, like, the best way to spread a disease.
Yeah, absolutely, and it seems like they don't. They don't spread it anywhere nearly as readily as adults do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, moving on to our last story, we're talking about the Chamoli disaster, which, can you go a little bit more in depth about this?
Yeah, so this happened back in February, and you may have seen some of the cell phone footage of this, and it was a terrible thing that happened. So a big... some of the cell phone footage showed this horrifying sort of wall of slurry racing down a steep slope, sweeping away just about everything in its path. Over 400 people died from that event, which was terrible. And this was in the north of India, in the Himalayas. And so an international group of more than 50 researchers have published a detailed assessment of what actually happened, based on multiple data sources from satellite imagery to field observations. And it's a pretty somber read, and reports numbers that honestly are sort of beyond comprehension. So the disaster was initiated close to the top of the 6 kilometers, so that 6,000 meter high Ronti peak in the Chamoli district of the Indian state of Uttarakhand. And what happened is that there was a wedge of glacier covered rock that was more than 500 meters wide and 180 meters thick, just basically let go of the mountainside. And the team calculated that almost 27 million cubic meters of material was put into a minute-long descent that at one point was in complete freefall.
That is insane.
Yeah. And so to put this volume in context, it's about 10 times that of the Great Pyramid of Giza. So Imagine that falling down into this valley. And when the mass hit the valley floor, it released enough energy that it was equivalent to 15 Hiroshima atomic bombs.
That's a lot of energy.
Which is horrifying, yeah. And the ratio of rock and ice was about 80 to 20. And that ratio, combined with the fall height of about 2 kilometers, 2,000 meters, was able to provide enough heat through all the friction of the rocks disintegrating and rubbing against each other to almost fully melt the ice and turn it into water before it even landed.
Wow.
Yep. And so when it did land, because this was a rock slurry basically surrounded now by water and not ice, it was very, very mobile. And it was able to travel tens of kilometers to much lower elevations down the valley. So on impact, the material sprayed the surrounding hillsides with large boulders, some about 10 meters wide. And the air blast, that's just the shock wave, flattened 20 hectares of nearby forest just from the thing landing. Ordinarily, most of that would have been expected to remain in place, but it didn't, because it was basically rock surrounded by liquid, so it's sort of the consistency of sort of wet concrete, and it headed off further down the slopes. And it ripped its way through a large hydroelectric plant 15 kilometers away. And at that time, the velocity of this sort of mass of rock and slurry was 25 meters per second. That's about 90 kilometers per hour.
That is insane for such a huge thing.
Yeah, with speed of a sort of a pretty fast moving car. And even 10 kilometers beyond that, it was still moving at about sort of half the rate, about 16 meters per second. So nearly all of those who died were either working in or visiting the power plant, this big hydroelectric station, and they had no warning. They had no idea what was coming towards them.
I can't imagine you ever would.
Yeah. And so this is horrifying. This is a terrible thing that happened. And the big question that people asked back in February was about climate change. Sort of always is with these sort of natural disasters at the moment, and the role it might have played in the disaster. And it's sort of a tricky question. And the team concluded that no single event can be ascribed to climate warming, as we've said before on the show. But they do make the point that the frequency of rock falls in the Himalaya is increasing as the temperature rises. So as the ice is melting, these rock formations become less stable, and these things start to happen. So it's just overall, these things will be expected to happen more and more. But this was a terrible disaster.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that, all of that, Alan. Sweet.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.